welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with Elena Schneider, who's written a book on the British occupation of Havana, a little-known event, little-discussed event that occurred in the 18th century. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Elena Schneider, author of The Occupation of Havana, War, Trade, and Slavery in the Atlantic World. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject?
Well, I only learned in 2004 that the British had invaded and occupied and ruled Havana for 1 year at the end of the Seven Years' War. And this was news to me when I stumbled across this in my PhD studies at Princeton, studying the history of the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And I just started to think, what would that have been like to imagine British rule over Havana and Cuba? Mm-hmm. And when I looked into the literature about it, it was little known in the United States, certainly even in Britain, that this had happened was little known. But what had been written had been, there had been more than produced in Cuba about it, and it had been sort of just a kind of military tactical approach. So my initial interest was, what would, you know, in some ways, Havana under British rule is imagining that as sort of like a world turned upside down. What would that have looked like? And so I thought that the military story had already been told, and I was really interested in the dynamics of military occupation. And this was at the same time as the U.S. occupation of Iraq. So I was thinking, you know, how do occupations work? Where did the laws of occupation originate? The international laws around, you know, occupation? What are the expectations for a military occupation on both sides? And then when I started to dig into the topic to do archival research, I saw that the military story also hadn't been told as much as I thought it needed to be. So I ended up telling a story of military history about the siege as well. When I started, I thought that had already been covered. But then when I started digging into the sources, in particular, I noticed that enslaved Africans and free black soldiers had played a surprisingly significant role in this battle, on both sides, in fact. And I thought that that wasn't as much a part of the way it had been written about. It had been described as more of a British naval victory, and the part that happened on land had been sort of understudied, I thought, from the British side. And I thought on both sides, you know, Cuban historians who'd written about it and British historians who'd written about it, and there are very few of them, but the few that had really underplayed that element. So then I went all in, and I was writing also a military history.
So tell me then, how is the book laid out? Is it chronological or is it by sort of subject matter?
Yeah, that's always the trick, how to best arrange your story. So what I felt that this was an event that drew in actors from all over the Atlantic world, people from Africa, from Spain, from Britain, from Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Jamaica, Martinique. And the storyline of how all these people converged in this British expedition on Havana and what happened there and the repercussions this event had required multiple overlapping storylines. So I've arranged it, the book, the central section is about the invasion itself and the occupation itself, but the roads into that part of the book have different starting points and different points of view. So I have I begin with a kind of deep history of British plotting against Havana from the age of piracy from Sir Francis Drake and look at the long backstory of British machinations against Havana and romanticization and exoticization of Havana and desire to get Spanish silver, desire to seize Havana just as they had seized Jamaica from the Spanish. And then I told another storyline with a different starting point that was sort of the making of Havana from the Spanish point of view, from the Cuban point of view. And then the center was really a moment by moment story of the tactical operations of the siege and defense of Havana. and then the surrender. And then I had I go very deeply into the occupation as an event that happened, of course, in Havana, but also had reactions all around the Atlantic world. Fireworks were set off in London when the news reached there that Havana had been captured. Sermons were preached in Boston about what Spanish possession might be next. So I tried to sort of move in and out of Havana when I was talking about the occupation. And then the final third of the book is I think very deeply about what the repercussions were for Cuba and for Spanish Empire. Spain wanted Havana back so desperately they gave up Florida to the British to trade to get Havana back at the end of the Seven Years' War. And they were, it was a real blow to the heart to lose Havana to the British. Contemporaries described it to the defeat of the Spanish Armada. So it became a moment of really soul searching for the Spanish king and his counselors about how to strengthen its empire against the British threat. And so I follow that storyline into a kind of new imperial policies on the Spanish side, and then what their repercussions were in Cuba for those that were most involved in the defense of Havana, the siege, and the occupation. So it has it, the whole span of the book goes from probably I start as early as the 1600s, and I go up to 1812. But it's about this one event. And I think because it's so focused on this event, I could sort of throw a long line in one direction or another. And in the afterword, I even talk about the Bay of Pigs, because the Bay of Pigs was another attack on Havana. And the U.S. obsession with Cuba, trying to control Cuba, various U.S. occupations, I'm arguing that they have deep cultural roots in a British obsession with Cuba, trying to control Cuba, see Cuba as this wealthy, desirable place to colonize or take over or annex potentially. So there's a way in which by focusing so narrowly on this event, I was able to throw a stone quite far back in time beforehand and up to the present. Which was fun for me. I really enjoyed doing that.
So what time period or what years does the actual fighting and occupation cover?
Yeah, so the fighting is just 6 weeks in the summer of 1762. And the occupation is 11 months. And it lasts until June of 1763. So it's really a sliver of time. And you have to think of how slow communication networks were at that time. So when news spread about what had happened in Havana, they had already started the peace negotiations to end the Seven Years' War. So this news obviously changed the course of the peace negotiations, but word eventually reached Havana by that spring that it would be returned to the Spanish. The Spanish would never end the war without some guarantee to get Havana back. They would have kept fighting. Havana was too crucial. It was crucial for the return of the silver galleons meeting in Havana, convoying and making their way back to Spain. It was a very wealthy, important city to Spanish Empire. They called it the key to the Indies. So it was only held by the British. The siege and the occupation together only lasted a year. But the lead up to it and the repercussions had really deep impacts across time.
So what part of New Spain sort of was the key during this period? Where did sort of that function shift in the interim?
Well, Cuba was in early Spanish colonialism. Cuba saw the story of it had its own gold boom very early in the 1500s and massive arrival of Spanish conquistadors, would-be conquistadors. And there was a real decimation of the native population. And then Mexico happened. So all the Spaniards wanted to leave Cuba. And they wanted to be in Mexico during the conquest of Tenochtitlan and the Mexico City. So Cuba became sort of, it gained new importance in Spanish Empire because all of the silver from Peru and Mexico had to make its way back to Europe. And Havana was the perfect port for the galleons to meet, to stock up on food, to gather enough sailors, and then leave the north coast of Cuba and catch the Gulf Stream and make their way in a large, large convoy back to Spain. Mm-hmm. So Spain's ascendance in Europe, their expansion into the Netherlands, into Italy, so much of that was made possible by New World silver that was passing through Havana. So Havana was seen, and they built these massive fortresses to protect the entrance to the port at Havana because of the treasure galleons going in and out. Mm-hmm. Pirates tried to attack them. One Dutch pirate, Piet Hein, was successful off the north coast of Havana, capturing a treasure galleon. But so Havana was crucial in the sort of nodes of transportation of that era for returning silver to Spain. Mm-hmm. But it also became a wealthy city. And by the time of the British attack in the 18th century, mm-hmm. it was the third most populous city in the hemisphere. It was the wealthy after Mexico City in Lima. Mm-hmm. It was the wealthiest city in the Caribbean. It was bigger than any city in North America. There was a lot of wealth being created there, a lot of private wealth there. And so British merchants were interested in the market there, getting access to that market to sell their manufactured goods and enslaved Africans. So there was another appeal besides the kind of geopolitics of rivalry with Spanish Empire. There was also appeal for this market for consumer goods and for enslaved people. So that was another part of the allure for the British. And another reason why the Spanish were very jealous of trying to get Havana back and protect it as their own.
Did Spanish ships, during this occupation period, did Spanish ships meet at another Caribbean city before traveling? Yeah. How did they manage that?
They just didn't make it back. Yeah. There was the British holding Havana disrupted the flow of silver back to Spain. Mm. No ships, none of the galleons made it back. And Another thing that was so embarrassing to Spain is that the Havana was the largest naval base in the Americas at the time, because so much of the Spanish Navy was stationed in Havana, and there was a really important naval shipyard. Mm-hmm. And across the 18th century, the Spanish built more and more warships, not in Iberia, but in Cuba, mm-hmm. in part because Cuba had wonderful hardwoods. And so they logged locally, and they built a large number of ships in the 18th century, including ships that fought at the Battle of Trafalgar. They built them in Havana. So when the British attacked Havana, two-fifths of the Spanish Navy was in the port of Havana.
Oh, wow.
And so due to a very bad tactical error, the Spanish governor was concerned about protecting the ships. The ships were in the harbor. So to keep the attacking British Navy from destroying the ships, he took two ships and sunk them at the entrance to Havana's Bay so the British ships couldn't sail in. Mm-hmm. But that just rendered all these Spanish ships useless. They took the cannons off them and mounted them on the city walls and used them to shoot at the British. Mm-hmm. But they rendered this impressive number of warships useless and trapped in the harbor during the whole siege. And when the British were finally successful with this, with the white flag coming up from the Spanish, they just gained two-fifths of the Spanish Navy sitting in port.
Oh, wow.
And they took all those ships, as you might imagine.
Huh.
And so, it was another reason it was such a blow and such an embarrassment to the Spanish to lose Havana, because they lost such a large portion of their Navy.
Wow. So, who on the British side organized and really pushed for this attack?
Yeah, William Pitt and so within British politics, William Pitt and then the mercantile interest groups, the Whigs, who were very pro-expansion, who were very interested in expanding markets for British goods, who were on sort of a rampage during the Seven Years' War, were very interested in new conquests. Quebec had just fallen. So there was a lot of pressure about attacking more territories. And when the Spanish declared war, when the Spanish allied with the French, the British were quick to jump on it. But then the plans had been in the making from earlier, but they were put into action very quickly. And at this point in the war, Britain had so many successes, not just in North America, in the Mediterranean region, but also in India. So they had military naval commanders who had experience globally over the years of the war before the British siege of Havana, that they were able to bring that military, the precision of how to organize a massive expedition. They've had a lot of practice during this point of the war in orchestrating such a massive expedition, and they had a lot of experienced naval commanders and soldiers and sailors. They had a lot of soldiers and sailors already mustered and mobilized. They had militia already organized. So they were able to strike very quickly. And in fact, the British Navy had been so dominant by this point in the war that they intercepted the Spanish news ships sent to Havana to warn that war had been declared. So the British expedition, this massive British expedition, arrived on the horizon bearing down on Havana before the governor had even been formally informed that Britain and Spain were at war. So there was a kind of escalation of the Seven Years' War and the kind of practice and coordination of all these other prior campaigns that aided the British attack.
Because I wasn't sure if it was a situation where the British got lucky and found Havana unprepared, but instead it sounds like it was a large coordinated effort to make this happen.
Yeah. And the other thing the British had learned, mostly from the experience of the War of Jenkins' Ear, which just 20 years prior, the British had launched a number of Caribbean campaigns, amphibious assault campaigns, basically. They had a failed attack on Cartagena in Colombia in 1741, and they had another failed attack, ironically, on Guantanamo in Cuba in just after that. And what they had learned was that they really needed to calculate for the effects of yellow fever in the Caribbean, and that when you amass a large group of non-immune individuals, the mosquitoes that carry yellow fever will just move it from one person to another to another. And that those mosquitoes and yellow fever are endemic in the Caribbean. And so they had learned, they didn't understand how yellow fever worked, but they did understand that in any Caribbean campaign, they would lose thousands and thousands of men to the fevers or the disease. They thought it was from sweating and overexerting themselves in the tropics. But they did know that they had to expect a very high toll from yellow fever. So they sent probably twice as many soldiers as they could practically need because they counted on losing that many. They knew that would happen. That had happened before at Cartagena. It had happened at Guantanamo. So the force that they mobilized to attack Havana was 28,000 people. That was more people than lived in New York City at the time. And the Spanish defenders had hardly more than 10,000 soldiers or militia. So the British really brought more than twice as many people because they were counting on the fact that after a couple of weeks in the tropics, they would start to have disease become a factor. They had learned this through prior campaigns and prior wars. So that was a factor in putting this massive expedition together.
Did yellow fever affect them as they expected?
Yeah, it did. They lost over 10,000 men to yellow fever. And what happens is that the greatest vulnerability comes after a rain when the mosquitoes hatch. And they attacked during the, wait for it, rainy season. So it was, they were trying to avoid the hurricane season, which is the fall. The British were doing all right. You know, they were losing casualties to the fighting. But the rains started pretty heavily. And by about, and this is, they knew this would happen, but by about a month in, that's when the disease really became a very serious factor. And the Spanish also were suffering from yellow fever. They had soldiers from Spain who were stationed in Havana would also be vulnerable, because they hadn't been exposed in their youth. They'd grown up in Europe. So there was yellow fever affecting some of the Spanish soldiers as well, but it was less of a factor for those born and raised in the Caribbean who'd been exposed in their youth. Mm-hmm. But it was really, the Spanish didn't realize quite how badly the British were suffering from yellow fever and the really increasingly miserable state of the troops. Mm-hmm. And the British commander was thinking about withdrawing. Just shortly before the victory. And in fact, North American troops were very delayed in arriving. There were some North American troops that were already there that had been brought from the siege of Martinique to attack Havana. Mm-hmm. But there was a contingent of over 5,000 troops who were militia from Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and South Carolina. They were very delayed. They shipwrecked on their way down. The British commander, Lord Albemarle, was very frustrated why they didn't show up. He needed them as yellow fever became more and more of a factor. They showed up right at the very end of the siege, right when yellow fever was rampant, and they died in astonishing numbers. They weren't actually that pivotal in the fighting. The fact that they arrived helped the commander keep the siege up, but then they fell in horrific numbers. I mean, there was a company from Rhode Island where 90% of the people died, a militia company. So they really took a really hard knock from the yellow fever.
I have a question about the capture of the 2/5 of the Spanish Navy. What effect did that have on the British Navy, you know, British finances, operations, strategic plans? You know, how much of an addition to the British Navy was that?
That's a really good question. I did a little bit of research on that, mm-hmm. and I think they sold a lot of the ships. In some ways, British warships had better technology than Spain, were faster, more mobile than Spanish warships. Mm-hmm. So I believe that they kept some of them and then they sold some of them. And some of that imperial chauvinism, I read reports from the Spanish ambassador in London of British diplomats poo-pooing the technology of the Spanish ships. Hmm. I didn't know how much to believe them.
Right.
But really, the gain, obviously all those ships were a great gain for the British when they seized Havana, but also the royal silver treasure that was held in Havana at that time was an enormous amount. So that was another tremendous boon, and that was not seized by the state so much as divvied up among all those on the expedition. So the war commanders, Lord Albemarle, George and William Keppel, they all made a killing and revived their family's fortunes based upon basically prize booty they seized in Havana, which was all this silver that was on its way back to Spain but being held in Havana at the time.
And how much of an effect did these events have? Because I think you said it was 62, and then you have the American Revolution happening, you know, 13, 14 years later. Did the deaths of these American colonists have any political implications? And you know, getting Florida, attaching Florida to the colonies, did that have an implication that you came across?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's been less thinking about what it meant for so many North American soldiers to die on this expedition in Cuba and what it meant. And this was only the second time North American provincial troops had served abroad on a British expedition. Mm-hmm. But I think you had to a kind of alienation that they'd been used as cannon fodder, I guess you could say. That so many of them had died, that can't have not created some kind of alienation from the families that lost individuals. And then there has been some interest in the fact that the deep hit that the British Army and Navy took in terms of loss of personnel and what that meant for Pontiac's Rebellion, which occurred just after in North America, that the British forces were very enfeebled at that moment and less able to send as many people to deal with Pontiac's Rebellion. So there has been some thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And then what I would say about Florida is that the Spanish were very upset about losing Florida, and it became a priority to try to win it back. Florida was mostly native controlled, and it was a kind of backwater of the imperial hotspots of the Americas at the time, but its location was crucial for defending the route of the treasure galleon back to Spain. So the Spanish became very fixated about on what they called reconquering Florida, the reconquest of Florida. And that was involved in, that was a motivation for why the Spanish became involved in the American Revolution, along with the French, supporting the 13 colonies, sending financial aid, war material, and troops to fight along the Gulf Coast, up the Mississippi River, Bernardo de Galvez, and the Battle of Pensacola, and the Spanish won Florida back briefly during the American Revolution. So it definitely became a motivation for the Spanish to continue to make more war on Britain, and then that led them to aiding the 13 colonies in the American Revolution.
Because I believe the tip of Florida provided good basis for attacks on the Spanish trade route. Is that correct? Or
indeed, yeah. And that's what the first settlement, first British interest in Florida, and even just along the northeastern seaboard, but in the south, Walter Raleigh's interest in settlement in the southeast was as a launching pad for attacking the treasure galleons. So very much. I mean, it's a very different kind of geopolitics. And you have to think of silver sort of driving the system, and places that had very different geographical significance and importance at the time. And Florida very much was seen as sort of a buffer and a protection. The Spanish also wanted Georgia back, which they believed was theirs. And that was, they were also thinking of it as a kind of buffer and protection for the circulations of their ships.
Mm-hmm. How did the citizens of Havana fare under the British? Did they not see much of a difference? Were they, you know, how did that work out?
Yeah. I went into this study thinking more about occupations that I was more familiar with. So World War II occupations and sort of what they looked like in a different era. But I really had to disabuse myself of what an occupation in the 18th century looked like as opposed to a 20th century military occupation. Because here was an enfeebled British army with massive numbers of people sick with yellow fever that didn't have this sort of tight-fisted ability to exert military authority over Havana. In fact, they were desperate for food, and they needed the local population to house them and to help them feed the army. Uh-huh. And so the Havana elites, you know, they had, Havana was a very large city at the time. It was used to hosting a lot of sailors passing through because of the treasure galleon. Mm-hmm. A lot of Havana elites had several houses, some of which they would rent out. So there was room to take the officers in and to fit the soldiers who were recovering in Havana. But the Havana elites also owned ranches in the hinterland where there was cattle. They had small farming operations all in the hinterland. And they were coerced, but they were also given incentive to help bring food in. And later, people on other parts of the island of Cuba accused the Havana elites of collaborating, being a sort of Vichy collaborators in Havana. But in their case, the Havana elites were actually, they had traded with British merchants in the past, and getting access to British trade goods, which were cheaper than those that passed through Spain, through Spanish monopolies, was quite attractive.
Yeah.
I don't think they thought that they would stay British for too long, but they could make some money while they were, they could make some connections, commercial connections, and they could, engage in some trade that would be free of Spanish taxation, and it could actually be not such a, it could be sort of a lucrative moment for them, and many people did make a lot of money during the British occupation. It was the population of African, half of Havana at the time was black people, and it was the population of African descent that was really much more in danger during the British occupation because they couldn't be certain that a British occupying army or British commanders would respect the fact that not all of them were enslaved, many of them were free, that, you know, their protections under the law were less guaranteed under occupying authority. So there was some violence between the occupying soldiers and people of African descent in Havana. And they didn't, there were, in the articles of capitulation, there were protections for the property, for the freedom of religion, for people in Havana, but nothing was said about free people of African descent or enslaved people. And the British commanders were interested in really cashing in after this brutal 6-week siege. So they were seizing black people and selling them to just try and make extra money, like war booty, from the campaign.
And I guess these slaves ended up in North America, or these freed people who were sold as slaves ended up in, I guess, North America?
Some of them were just resold back in Havana. And then some of the people who were free black soldiers who fought and were taken captive, they got off the island. They left Cuba, and maybe, and I followed one person who went to Jamaica. Then he circled back and made his way to Spain, and then he was able to return to Havana. But at that point, Havana was a really wealthy city, and it was a better market for enslaved Africans than North America was. So any British officer or any commander that had an enslaved person that they wanted to sell, they actually had incentive to just sell them right there in Havana, even if they were selling them back to Havana elites. They were more interested in selling in Havana, not having to deal with the hassle of transportation costs, of selling someone in North America. They mostly resold them locally.
Mm-hmm. I guess I wasn't sure if how sort of international the slave market in Havana was. Like, it, you know, I'm not sure if slave traders might have arrived from other countries and taken, you know, enslaved people back somewhere else.
No, that's a good point. Well, I think because Havana was seen as a place that had a lot of silver currency, and that was in short supply in the Americas at the time and very desirable for people to get their hands on it. So there were actually enslaved people that had been captured by the expedition or rented out or even bought by the expedition in Antigua, Martinique, in Jamaica, that they just sold in Havana because Havana had a lot of demand for enslaved Africans and had money to pay for them. So if anything, people from enslaved people from other parts of the Caribbean were sort of dumped and sold in Havana because that was an attractive place to sell them at the time. It was a very attractive market.
So let me turn to the resources you used for your research. Where did you find your primary documents?
That was the most fun part of this. I went to so many different archives in so many different countries. And in some ways, I was trying to look at this event, but look at it from both sides. So I had double layers of how the British described what happened and how the Spanish described what happened. But I think the largest chunk of material that I used was from the Spanish imperial archives in Seville in Spain. They have a massive archive there that covers the colonial period for all of Latin America and the Philippines. And so the majority of the material for colonial Cuba is still held in Spain. So I spent probably 8 months total working in those archives in southern Spain and also Madrid. But I also researched a good deal in Havana. There are, because I love Havana, and I wanted to really have a strong sense of the texture of the city. And those fortresses still stand. I needed to see what they look like and know what the bay was like and understand the architecture, the built environment of the city. And then there are also sources that I could only find in Cuba. And those are very local sources, like the city council minutes. Or I spent a lot of time looking at notarial protocols. So those would be things like receipts of bills of sale that are recorded in these huge volumes. So I looked at the British occupation, what was being sold, who was buying what. I researched that in Cuba. But I also spent a lot of time in London at the British National Archive, at Kew Gardens, and at the British Library, and some smaller regional collections where the papers of those involved in the siege were kept. And I had the kind of, I could sort of cross layer the different points of view on the same events and have a kind of double sourcing to help me see what was being emphasized by each side and what might get kind of lost in the middle. And I did I researched in Jamaica as well, because I was very interested in the relationship between Cuba and Jamaica and those people from Jamaica that were also caught up in the expedition.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you come across any, apart from the documents, the books of documents, any physical objects that you found interesting, maybe didn't really add much to the history, but maybe you found interesting to come across?
Yeah, that was, I've always loved art history and painting, and in my teaching, I always really emphasize material culture, objects. What can objects tell us about the past? So I was sort of primed to be looking for that sort of material in the first place, but there were some fantastic items that helped make the case that I was trying to make, that this was a major event in 18th century history. So in collections in England and even in Portugal and in Spain, I found commemorative items that were created about the siege. What my favorite was probably in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich in London. They have a toasting glass that has an image that says the 12th of August is a very great day to toast, which that was the day of Havana's surrender. Yeah. And it has a palm tree. And so it's a glass that was made just to toast the fall of Havana. And you can imagine the kinds of celebrations that were happening and the excitement over potentially gaining Havana for British Empire that was unleashed at that moment in all these households across Britain. So that was one of my favorites.
That is pretty interesting. Yeah. I can imagine these naval dinners, you know, where they all hear.
And there were Havana drinking songs that were published and sold. So a number, I'm sure people often improvise drinking songs, but there were actually some that were written down and published that were drinking songs about the fall of Havana.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what did you find in your research that was most surprising?
I think that I've been working on this project for so long that I thought it was one thing, and then it shifted over time. And as I kept following different leads, the story became something I didn't realize it was initially. And I think maybe what surprised, the first thing that surprised me the most was, wow, look at how many free black militia and enslaved Africans were involved in this event. When we talk about a clash between Britain and Spain in the Seven Years' War, you don't think of that as being fought by black people on both sides, certainly. So that was my first big surprise, because also the other literature I'd read about this event didn't talk about their role as much. So that was my first big surprise. And then I really tried to think, you know, I mentioned I was thinking about an event and the meanings it has over different time spans from different points of view. So I was trying to think very deeply about what it meant to descendants of the people who had fought in Cuba against the British attack, people who had distinguished themselves for their role in trying to fend off the British, people who'd received medals for their service. What did it mean many generations later, a couple generations later, when Spanish policies went in different directions, and particularly for free black people in Cuba? Some of these soldiers received medals, received pensions, and I even traced a couple of them that were sent to Madrid and got to meet the Spanish king, kiss his hand, receive a medal from him, perform a display of arms. Then they come back, and over the next 30 years or so in Cuba, the new policies are very pro-slave trading, and the racial hierarchy becomes much sharper and more defined. And it becomes harder and harder to be a free black person in a society that's more and more based upon sugar plantation slavery. And the black troops are being deployed less and less. Those that own a lot of enslaved people do not feel comfortable with black people walking around with guns anymore. So the descendants of these soldiers, and some of them later in their military career, found themselves increasingly marginalized. But they remembered what their elders had done and the way they'd been treated during the Siege of Havana. And what surprised me is that I was looking at evidence about a slave rebellion that happened 50 years later in Cuba. And some of the free black militia were involved in it. And this is surprising because the free black militia didn't normally take common cause with the enslaved. The free black militia were often very elite members of black society. And they thought of themselves as very different from enslaved people on plantations. And in the past, they had never sought a common cause or become involved in any kind of slave rebellion. And when I looked at some of the documentation from the slave rebellion 50 years after the siege, the person who led it was a member of the Free Black Militias whose grandfather had fought in the Siege of Havana. And some of the evidence they found in his house was a painting he had made of his grandfather fighting off the British, slaying British soldiers, attacking and capturing English officers. And so that made really surprised me that there was this very different memory of the Siege of Havana and the defense of Havana that was held within this black community of soldiers. And that in some ways could be an argument for we shouldn't be treated like this. Look how powerful our ancestors were. And also could have been held up as an example of, look, we can defeat white people. We did once before when they attacked us. So the event had very different meanings depending on whose point of view you were taking.
So this piece of this art or illustration you just described, where is that found? Where was that?
Well, this is what's so amazing about this slave rebellion. It happened in 1812. It's called the Aponte Rebellion in Cuba. It was the first major slave rebellion and the first major anti-colonial rebellion in Cuba. And one of the main pieces of evidence used against this man who'd been, he was a free black in Havana. He was a carpenter and he was a member of the free black militia. One of the main pieces of evidence used against him was this book of drawings and paintings that they found in his house that they claimed he'd been showing to his accomplices to help sort of indoctrinate them and organize the rebellion. And it's called, it's been referred to by scholars as the Book of Paintings. And in the trial testimony, they ask him about every single image and he describes each image. They ask his accomplices about each image. So there are 600 pages of trial testimony that talk in great detail about this book, but the book has been lost. So we don't actually have the book. All we have is the trial testimony describing it. So I've read Aponte himself and several of his accomplices describing these images that are actually scenes of the defense of Havana against British attack from 50 years prior. And I was able to take what they were describing that was in the images and compare it to what I knew had happened and realized it was entirely accurate what he was describing. And to understand a little bit of why black men in Havana whose grandparents had fought would have remembered the defense of Havana as a very noble, proud moment for black soldiers and how that memory would add to this sense of betrayal as they're getting treated worse and worse over the years that followed.
Can you briefly mention on both sides, the troops, the black troops, did they have regimental designations or anything like that that they were part of? Do you know any of that offhand?
On the Spanish side, they were chiefly in militia companies. And they were organized by race. So there was the militia companies of blacks, or morenos, they called them, and then those of mixed race, or pardos, or is what they called them. So those who had black and white ancestry. And they separated them out into separate militia companies. And on the British side, they raised about 500 free black troops. These were also militia companies from Jamaica. And then they also brought thousands, over 2,000 enslaved Africans And they, so the militias were kept together and used as a unit. They often, on the British side, they did more support work and less of the direct fighting, the Free Black Militia. But the enslaved Africans that were brought were parceled out all to different companies. So basically, each company had a set number of enslaved people to assist them with the work that nobody wanted to do, basically. And that meant hauling cannons, chopping wood, that kind of manual labor that's a crucial part of warfare.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What was the most difficult thing to research during your studies?
I think that I realized the hardest thing was I knew that Havana's population was half white people and half black people at the time that I studied. But the archives are created by white people, about white people, and black people show up in them sometimes because they're buying something or they own a house or they're making a petition or something, but they also show up because when they're property of the white people. So I basically had, you know, a pile of material this high about the white people and a pile of material, you know, this high about black people. But I knew that, you know, they were each half of the population. So I had to spend more time kind of working up and doing sleuthing detective work to try and build up the story about black people in Havana. And I had to take more time and do more creative thinking to build out the story about black people, where white people's story was heavily documented by comparison. So that I had to sort of push it down in comparison to what I had on the other side. And I didn't, just because the archives had more to say about white people because white people wrote them more, didn't mean that my story should be overwhelmingly about white people. Mm-hmm. And so how to do that was a challenge. And basically it took a lot of years and a lot of kind of around the back door research tactics, circling back around, looking at documents from much later that were reflecting on what had happened earlier, talking to people who gave me leads. It just took it took longer and it was a lot harder.
Was there anything you discovered that had an emotional impact on you in some way, either negative or something happy?
Yeah. I found the accounts of the siege itself and the terror, the you know, risk to people's lives, the fear, the flight, the chaos. I found that really powerful and I didn't want to lose that. I feel like sometimes military history is so orderly and it depicts battles. Sometimes, not many people don't do this, but sometimes it makes battles look like battle plans. And a lot of what I saw when I read letters that were written during the weeks of the siege was terror, chaos, flight. And so I wanted that feeling to be part of the book. I also, the way the British actually succeed is they blow up a mine under the Moro Fortress, which is the massive fortress guarding the entrance to Havana. And that mine was shocking. No one had ever blown up a mine with no warning under one of these massive Spanish Caribbean forts. And hundreds of people died when the mine went off. And that kind of shock of the mine, that this was an unprecedented step in warfare in the Caribbean, at least. And how scary that booming sound and the dust and the debris and all the people that had been already getting battered by cannon fire inside the Moro Fortress and then the mine goes off. So I really wanted to make that come alive as much as I could for the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So that was important to me. And then I also really, as you can tell probably from what I was saying earlier, this story of black troops who had risked their lives for an empire that ends up betraying them was very powerful. And I found a letter of complaint from some of the black veterans of the siege in Cuba that had been written just 25 years after the siege. And one of their fellow soldiers had been whipped to death on the streets of Havana, and they were writing a letter of complaint. And they said, you wouldn't believe the way they treat us like dogs in Havana, even though we wear Your Majesty's uniform. That was the line that they wrote in this letter. They sent it to the king. They said, you wouldn't believe what's happening here. This is not according to your laws. We are your loyal troops. You've honored our members before in a ceremony at the royal court. And these things are happening to us now. And that letter and the violence against that soldier really, really resonated with me, hit me very powerfully, and shaped the way I wanted the ending of the book to go. I wanted the feelings of betrayal from these black soldiers to be a central part of how people understand the aftermath of this incident.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope the book will do?
Well, that's a good question. Some ways, nobody knows anything about this early period in Cuban history. Everybody loves Cuban history, at least the people I meet. But it's the Cuban Revolution. It's the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's the Bay of Pigs. Or even those that study Cuban history pay a lot more attention to the 19th century, to the Spanish-American War, to the sugar plantations and incredible wealth and misery of 19th century Cuba. And 18th century Cuba, the subject of my book, is another world. It's another Cuba. To me, it's a fascinating place. And I think of that massive Moro fortress at the Bay of Havana, this sprawling, wealthy, colonial city, the Spanish silver, these free black troops, the kind of trade that passed through Havana, the wealth there. I'm fascinated with this time period in Cuban history, and there are very few people that write about it. So I wanted other people to sort of unlock that world for other people. Mm-hmm. And as you can tell, I also really wanted, you can see what I did on the cover. Mm-hmm. This is a painting of free black soldier in Cuba that was done by a artist of color in Havana. But I wanted black soldiers to be seen as central to this event. So I spliced this painting on top of a British painting of the Moro castle being exploded after the mine. Because I wanted to sort of recenter the story on these men of color in Havana.
Okay. Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book finished and published and how you overcame those?
Well, for getting it published, I had a postdoctoral fellowship in Williamsburg, Virginia, at the Omohundro Institute. It's at the College of William & Mary. And that fellowship came with the commitment to publish my book. And they also are known for producing really beautiful editions. And they let me put in so many images, which were really important to my story. So, and I actually had also worked in book publishing. So I knew to really prioritize trying to have a good publisher and the right publisher. So I was able to set that up earlier. But for me, the hardest part was I wrote this first as a dissertation. I rewrote it, and then I rewrote it again. I probably rewrote it two or three times. And you have to cut a lot, and you have to compress. And you can't – I really wanted to be kind to my reader. And there are many things that I researched and I thought were fascinating that was just too much detail. And I wanted it to be a story that could draw people in. So I had to spend a lot of time rewriting, revising, cutting, compressing, clarifying. There was a middle version of the book that was much longer. And then the time I put in, and it's very difficult trying to cut and figure out what you can do with that when you're very attached. Things that it took years to find in some obscure archive in southwestern England, that does the reader really need to know that? No, I need to know that because it informs my analysis. But, you know, instead of five details, what's the one detail that will make my point and really resonate with the reader and cut the rest of them? And so make it, you know, I really wanted to prioritize the reader's experience. But it took a lot of rewriting. And for me, you know, writing is really rewriting, revising. And I spent a lot of time doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that, you know, from other historians that they've had to cut out things they consider important but didn't quite fit the book. And it seems like in today's age, You can have your book, and then people who want more, you know, can access it through, you know, maybe blog posts or something. You know, it feels like that information shouldn't just end up on the cutting floor, you know.
I think that's true. Yeah, people either having a website related to your book that has sort of outtakes or additional materials, that's a cool option I see people pursuing. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes in order to cut it, authors have to tell themselves, oh, I'll just publish this in another article. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't get around to doing that.
Yeah.
But it makes it easier to cut thinking that, oh, I could put this right somewhere else. Or even there's stuff I've cut that I would work on in a different project. You know, I think with the first book, this is my first book. With the first book in particular, you kind of want to put everything you know in it, but there'll be other books. There'll be other articles, other things, you know, save some of it. You don't have to put it all in the first one.
Huh.
So that's sort of my consolation, for all the stuff I cut.
So what's your next writing project?
I'm working on a couple things, but, one of them has to do with the Spanish involvement in the American Revolution. The French story is much better known. Both the Spanish involvement was staged from Cuba. In Cuba, there's a wide awareness that soldiers from there and aid from there were a crucial aid to the cause of the 13 colonies during the American Revolution. But in the U.S., we don't seem to know this. So mm-hmm. I wanted to look at that and also the role of the French colony of Saint-Domingue, what becomes Haiti, and also staging French aid. So that's something I've been working on. And another thing I'm working on has to do with those people who ran away from slavery in the Caribbean, but did so by either building or stealing boats and escaping from one island and empire to another. Many people escaped to Cuba that way from the British colony of Jamaica or the French colony of Saint-Domingue, what becomes Haiti. And I'm interested in sort of looking at what are the major routes. It's like an underground railroad for the Caribbean, and it involves boats, not overland trips. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to think about how to map some of those routes. That's another thing I'm working on.
Hmm. Okay. Where can people find the book online and also your thoughts and other writings and such?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. The book is available at Amazon and also University of North Carolina Press. Mm-hmm. You can order it from them directly if you'd like. And I have written a blog post on the Age of Revolutions webpage, which is excellent. And I've written a blog post there about the struggle of black soldiers in Cuba. It's on my faculty webpage at the University of California, Berkeley.
Okay.
And there are links to everything there as well. And other articles I've written are on my faculty webpage at UC Berkeley.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
No, I just hope that, I hope that people follow me. And for me, I never thought I would write a book about an amphibious military operation, a siege of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some of the details of how it worked and how armies worked and how sieges operated were absolutely fascinating. So in some ways, my journey in, I hope it draws other people in who wouldn't know to find this world fascinating. And those that are already interested in this, you know, I hope they appreciate a kind of different perspective on it, or an attempt to engage in a different way. But that I never knew what I would, I found this to be a fascinating and strange incident. And then I just started following pathways into it, and it sort of opened up worlds. So even if the incident seems strange or unusual, I encourage people to sort of follow me into the stories behind it, because there was so much there that I found over the many years of researching this book. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Yeah, I want to thank you for writing this, because just as a fan of 18th century history and North American history, I think it's what you've described is some really important research that may, you know, that probably will change the way historians and fans of history see some of what you discussed.
Well, thank you. I hope that people who work on North America or the British West Indies at this time, I'm really eager to hear feedback and connections and things that I haven't thought about in my attempt to sort of write Cuba into that story. So it's a fun dialogue, and I hope it'll be ongoing.
Mm-hmm. And I should add European history, of course, as well, the repercussions there. So, yeah, but yeah, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.